The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, Tech Weekly fans. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week on the show, The Guardian's Stuart Dredge reports from this year's South by Southwest Festival. We'll be finding out what's defining the tech scene as the geeks gather in Austin, Texas. Also, I'll be joined by Charles Arthur and Samuel Gibbs to discuss the news this week about Apple's latest tax efficiencies as they move profits from Australia to Ireland. And finally, ahead of the BAFTA Awards for Excellence in Computer Gaming, The Guardian's Keith Stewart meets three of this year's nominees to talk Crocs versus T-shirts. No, not true. To discuss the best of UK gaming. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian.
The NSA, the sort of global mass surveillance that's occurring in all of these countries, not just the US, and it's important to remember that this is a global issue, they're setting fire to the future of the internet. And the people who are in this room now, you guys are all the firefighters. When you are the country...
The voice of whistleblower Edward Snowden, whose Google Hangout address to several packed rooms of tech-savvy folk in Austin, Texas, and indeed live-streamed to millions around the world, kicked off this year's South by Southwest Interactive Festival. That's a bit of a coup. Joining me from Austin is The Guardian's Stuart Dredge. Stuart, how was Edward Snowden's address received? Was it a crowd pleaser, do you think, or was there more meat to the bones?
It's kind of a mix of both. It was really interesting because it was like a rock concert setting. It's in this big exhibition hall that's kind of like Earl's Court. And then these great big screens with Edward Snowden and Julian Assange as well, as a similar one, where everyone sort of sat there like you're watching a Coldplay or someone in a gig and just sort of wrapped in tension. So it was good. I mean, it was kind of like a lap of honor for Snowden. Like, it was, everyone was there to applaud him, and he got a standing ovation at the end. And it was very much the crowd that think he's amazing and what he's done is brilliant. So it was kind of like a sort of fan convention for Edward Snowden in a surreal way.
And what was some of the meat on the bones of the keynote that he gave?
Yeah, so I mean, part of it was him responding to the criticism he's had from some of the figures in the US. So he was kind of hitting back at the idea that he'd harmed security. There was him and Assange both were talking about what happens now. Like, now they've had these revelations, now we know what's happening, what needs to happen next. And there was a sense they're trying to move the conversation on to what kind of oversight do we need, what needs to happen to the NSA, what steps should we take. And they were both kind of doing this idea of, if you're a normal person, you've possibly been awakened to this in the last sort of 6 months to a year. So what are you going to do? How are you going to press for changes? So it was very much like a kind of a rallying the movement to not just say the NSA is awful, this is dreadful, but to say, what do we do now? How do we change this? How do we take that?
So, Stuart, was Edward Snowden and Julian Assange at another keynote, were they very US-centric, or were they looking more globally at some of the issues that they basically have forced raised in a lot of conversations around dinner tables and sort of pubs?
I think a mixture of both. I mean, there was a strong sense, particularly in Snowden, I think, was saying that the US needs to sort this out because everyone's data is going through the US. And they were addressing Google and Facebook and all these companies and saying that the US needs to lead now on sorting this out, because if they don't, the rest of the world will follow their bad example. So, yeah, there was definitely a message to US legislators, US government, with the idea that if the US sorts it out, the rest of the world will follow their lead, which seems quite optimistic, but... Yeah, but it was very. I think the debate has been very US-centric, and that Snowden was responding to criticism from US intelligence figures, and it was very much his chance to kind of come out and say, they said this about me and it was wrong. So yeah, there was quite a US aspect to it, but they're sort of seeing it would be a global thing.
Is there a sense that this year is kind of dominated by this kind of thing, by responses to the NSA revelations, to WikiLeaks, particularly looking as these are the headline speakers at the conference?
I think so. And it's been good because there's a lot less people banging on about the latest vaguely nice app that Silicon Valley is getting excited about. Like in the audience, it was like, there's one year when they were saying, the new thing is Highlight, which tells you who people are when they go past you. And everyone said, no, it's not. It's rubbish. And this year, I think there is that going on. There's lots of startups here, but people are getting to grips with these issues. And there were a lot of smaller sessions discussing what now. I mean, there was a really good session that Jemima, our boss, was on, about why didn't tech journalists break PRISM? And there was a lot, there was a whole session of soul searching there, saying, well, why didn't TechCrunch or All Things Digital or like tech things, why didn't they break this story? Why was it left to
I don't know, why not? What did they decide?
There was a really big moment of kind of self-awareness where I think Alexia, who goes to TechCrunch, said, well, we've been writing up press releases in this billion-dollar industry that we're part of. And I think a lot of people, I mean, I'm here thinking, you know, I write about things like Flappy Bird normally, and I like doing that, it's fun. But I'm here now saying, well, I need to engage with this as a citizen, as well as a journalist. You know, it's made me think about what I do. I think a lot of people here maybe it's made them reassess what's important, and that maybe the new social app might be fun, but there is important stuff to talk about. So it's been quite good. Like there is all the branded stuff that stuff people moan about. There's like Lady Gaga doing a Doritos gig, but there is also a lot that we're engaging with. What Snowden and the NSA mean and what to do next.
Well, if you do want to hear a good analysis of Julian Assange and the goings-on after WikiLeaks, the London Review of Books, the LRB, had a fantastic long-form article by author Andrew O'Hagan, who was given the task of ghostwriting Assange's autobiography, but for The Guardian's coverage of everything South by Southwest Interactive and South by Southwest Film and South by Southwest Music, head to theguardian.com/technology. This week, Guardian Australia's Paul Farrell reported that Apple moved billions in profits out of Australia and into its Irish subsidiary. It's raised cries of tax efficiencies, a familiar story for headline readers in the UK from not so long ago. Charles Arthur and Samuel Gibbs join me in the studio now to discuss this. Charles, what does Apple's tax strategy tell us about the company?
It tells us it's sort of like all the big multinationals. It basically doesn't want to pay any tax if it can possibly avoid it, because then it can have more profits to report to Wall Street. And you know, that's exactly the same whether you look at Microsoft, Apple, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, Starbucks. You know, just keep naming companies and it'll be the same. I mean, I've seen the same criticism leveled at British multinationals, which operate in, you know, overseas, that they similarly use tax structures, which mean that they don't have to pay you know, much in the way of taxes in countries where they have operations, and that it's all remitted back towards the UK or to, you know, places with favourable tax structures. But I mean, what you tend to see is companies using intermediate countries and one sort of or another of sort of companies which are in effect shells. Money is moved from one to the other. There's some sort of arrangement whereby there's service fees or things like this. And essentially the money all sort of, you know, accumulates, it tends to accumulate offshore, actually. I mean, Microsoft certainly has a big issue, and Apple has a big issue as well, with money that it's made as profits overseas, but which it doesn't want to repatriate to the United States because it would get taxed fairly heavily on it. So Microsoft, for example, was actually able to use that to its advantage. It bought Nokia with the overseas money, which meant that it was about 20%, 30% cheaper than if it had used money from its US banks.
Tax efficient.
It's money off phone handsets here. So, you know, what does it tell us? Well, what it sort of does tell us is that journalism is improving in the sense that, you know, people are more aware and awake to these sorts of avoidances, I guess you would call them. And, you know, Eric Schmidt has been taken to task on this. I was there at the Google Big Tent last summer when he was asked, or challenged pretty much directly by this, about this by Ed Miliband. And he says, well, you know, we follow the laws of the country. If they make us pay more tax, then we will. Which sort of is an answer and isn't an answer. You know, it's sort of, you know, people feel, well, if your company is there, then it's not. And, you know, all of the companies, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Starbucks, Facebook,
Vodafone.
Twitter, they've all, Vodafone,
and
yeah.
Absolutely. And indeed, you know, we've got, there were huge allegations towards authors. There were allegations towards celebrities for this as well. So it isn't just the big business that's doing it. It's also the individuals who are benefiting, shall we say, from some of the slippery efficiencies that are out there. So let's go back to this particular story. Samuel, what are the details of this efficiency?
So essentially, it seems like Apple's managing to find some sort of loophole that allows them to funnel money from Australia into its Ireland subsidiary via Singapore. And so its pre-taxed earnings were reported in Australia of $88.5 million, of which $2 billion of income was sent to Ireland via Singapore in the same period. So it's kind of unbalanced. And as you can imagine, Australian companies are operating in Australia and attempting to compete with Apple are rather cheesed off about this because they do not have the same ability to basically funnel profits outside the country and avoid paying tax on it.
Well, another Apple news. There's a book out that's called Haunted Empire, Apple After Steve Jobs. Charles, you're probably closer to Apple than most people, having published your own book, Digital Wars, about the big three tech companies. So tell me, in your research, did you discover that Apple is haunted by the specter of Steve Jobs?
Well, I was sort of hoping that this book by Yukari Abatani-Kane, who used to be a Wall Street Journal reporter who followed Apple from about 2011 onwards, I was really hoping that she would tell us, you know, is Apple in effect haunted? Do they sort of wander the corridors going, I wish Steve was back? Or do they go around going, yeah, that Steve Jobs guy, he was a bit of a jerk, wasn't he? It's sort of, you expect that it's going to do this because she says in the author's note, which is right at the front, she says, I did 200 interviews and I did, spoke to tons and tons of people and did this and that. You think, okay, well, then she's definitely must have spoken to, people who'll know this and will give us a picture. But what I found was that it just didn't tell me any of this. I really got no picture of what the mood is inside Apple at all. It read very much more like a sort of an outsider's view, with no insight that I could feel as to what the mood is and what the thinking is. And I mean, in the time since Steve Jobs died, and I'd sort of say that I found it. Quite teeth grinding the way that she would talk about him passing, Steve Jobs' passing. He didn't pass, he died. Okay, he just, came to a stop. I found it rather strange that she wasn't, going into this. I've spoken to people at Apple, since then. And my impression is they sort of go, that was that time. And now we're getting on with our own stuff. And it's not quite the same company, but then you wouldn't sort of expect that it would be because it's got someone different at the helm. And Tim Cook is a different personality from Steve Jobs. But again, is the company able to do the same sorts of things? Well, we don't know yet. It was sort of 6 years between the iPod and the iPhone, or five and a half or so. And it was three years between the iPhone and the iPad. And it's been what? It's been nearly 4 years now. It's been 4 years since the iPad. So you're sort of somewhere in the middle. And the expectation is, the sort of indications are from Tim Cook that something's going to happen this year.
I was just about to say on the whole new products thing that Tim Cook keeps promising new categories, and he's reiterated twice, both in an earnings call and in a interview, that Apple's pursuing new categories, but it doesn't have quite anything to show just yet. And while we can only speculate at these new categories, I should think something. Its hobby, which is no longer really a hobby considering how many it's selling, its Apple TV is definitely one of the growth areas. But there's lots and lots of speculation that it's going to be releasing some sort of smartwatch. And I can definitely see it working on a smartwatch, especially with Siri integration.
Well, you can read all of The Guardian's Apple coverage at theguardian.com/technology. Now that the Oscars are over, the real award season can begin. BAFTA's Awards for Computer Gaming Excellence will shortly be upon us, and The Guardian's games editor Keith Stewart met up with some of the shortlisted developers ahead of the big event.
Okay, welcome to Tech Weekly. Thanks for coming along, gentlemen. If you could, let's get your names first of all. Dan, who are you and what do you do?
I'm Dan Pierce. I'm one half of the Tall Trees, and we made Castles in the Sky, which has been nominated for the debut games category in this year's BAFTAs.
And with you is the other half of Tall Trees Games.
I'm the other half of the Tall Trees. I'm Jack DeKeat, and I'm the writer and composer on Castles in the Sky.
And we also have...
Barry Mead. I'm the commercial director of Fireproof Studios. We made a game called The Room, which is also up for the award.
So Barry, you're up in two categories this year, aren't you, I think?
Yes, we are.
Are you nervous?
Not really, actually. To be nominated is honestly enough. To be nominated, to be able to turn up at the party, get dolled up, have a good night, that's honestly as much as you could expect really from it. And winning is a total bonus on top of that.
Yeah. And you're in, it's best mobile and handheld.
Yeah,
and
best British game.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about The Room, just for people who haven't played? Because this is The Room 2 that's nominated this year, which is the sequel to The Room, which was an iPad-only game, isn't it?
No, it came out first on iPad, but it's on Android and Kindle as well. So far, but it's not. Yeah, it's mobile only, you should say, I guess. We released it in September 2012, the first one, and it was a kind of a small game, I guess. We made it with a quite small team in 7 or 8 months, and we were just basically hugely surprised by the reaction to the game when it was released, and it got featured by Apple, which gave it loads of promotion. So then it went on to do very well. It's basically a puzzle game, a sort of atmospheric puzzle game, I suppose you could say, which is about interacting with 3D objects and trying to figure out how to kind of crack the code, you're more or less breaking into them to find out what's inside, and that's and then when you break into that, you find there's another puzzle inside to crack, and so it's that's basically the gameplay setup of it. And then I think with The Room 2, then we just expanded that a wee bit to be to have different spaces, so you're actually maneuvering through space as well, or sorry, spaces to different boxes.
Yeah, because what I loved about the first game is, you know, it's a series of small kind of puzzle boxes which you have to figure out, and there's a narrative going on in the background, quite a sort of tense scientific semi-supernatural story in it. But really, it was the sense of, I think your game kind of used the touchscreen in a really interesting way, because you're really kind of being tactile with these objects on screen. You could spin them around, open the lids up. There was a real kind of sense that you actually had this object in your hands, which I think is one of the reasons why it was so successful.
Excuse me. I think that's definitely the case. When we were putting the game together, we thought we could only really afford to make a game on a mobile platform. So we thought, well, whatever we do has to play to the strengths of in this case it was the iPad or, you know, tablets. And so we went out of our way to make to try to come up with ideas that would use the touch interface really well, that would just sort of work in sympathy with it rather than having to get over it as a problem, which a lot of games treat it as. And, you know, really that was just, you know, the reason we'd wanted to do that was just simply to make it play better, you know, to make it feel better for people, and also just to do right by the platform, to not pretend that we're, you know, because we come from a console gaming background ourselves, and we spent many years doing that, console and PC games, and we just didn't want to approach the mobile with the same attitude, because we thought it was just sort of selling short the audience then, and also, you're bypassing a chance to do something slightly different or slightly new or more interesting by taking all of the tropes of console gaming to mobile. You're definitely missing something there. And so we kind of alighted on the idea for The Room. You know, we knew before we'd made it that it was probably a good idea for the mobile tablets, but it wasn't until we actually had a demo up and running after a few weeks and we had the game working that we realised that, oh, actually, this is quite interesting, and it's sort of interesting in its own right. Do you know what I mean? And so, yeah, once we showed the game to Apple, they liked the game. They told us that, you know, just keep going. We think it's really good. And that gave us the confidence then to just run with the idea, so... Yeah, it was. We really did want to do something that was right for the platform. It wasn't just about making the game that we wanted to make. It was to make something that people who own this platform would be happy to have.
Yeah.
And that was the sort of motivation for it.
Okay. And Dan and Jack, Could you tell us a little bit about your game, Castles in the Sky, which is your debut game? Tell us a little bit about it, because it's sort of an interactive story in a way, rather than a straightforward game, isn't it? It's very heavily narrative based.
Yeah, we internally we call it a video game picture book, in the sense that we feel that it's not necessarily like a direct transposition of a picture book to a screen, to a video game platform. You know, there's no turning of pages or anything. But in terms of narrative goals and in terms of the kind of feel that we want the game to lend to the player, it's very much the same feeling, at least that we're aiming for, is of exploring a picture book with a parent or a child.
Yeah. And it follows a small boy who is holding onto a balloon, and the balloon goes into the sky, and it's kind of his adventures as he moves up through the sky, through the clouds.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm based in Bath, and I spend a lot of time travelling on trains. And one of my favourite things about travelling on trains is that you can look out of the windows and you can see really, often really interesting things happening, but you can only see them for about 5 seconds. And then they're gone. So you have this amazing moment where you're peering out of the window and you're like, oh man, all those horses are running across the field. There's like 15 horses. Oh, it's gone now. And that's really interesting to me, this sort of... there's a sort of magic granted to small, interesting events by the fact that they're so transient. And the idea of somebody, a character, traveling through a world, traveling through a space, and encountering interesting things, but only really as temporary stopping points on their journey, is something that's really interesting to me, and I think it's interesting to Dan too.
Yeah, it's definitely something that we're very keen on, sort of having these very, like, constructed, fleeting moments where the player has just enough time to hopefully be sort of awe-inspired and really sort of in love with this moment, and then it's gone, and there's this sort of, I don't want to say sadness to it, because we didn't want to make a sad game, but it's sort of this thing where you encounter these really, really nice moments that you remember, and they don't outstay their welcome, because we don't want to give the player time
hopefully,
because you don't want to give the player time to get sort of bored with them.
Yeah, Castles is a really, really short game. I think there's a kind of worrying trend in development and in reception of games lately where length is considered often a marker of quality. Mm-hmm. But for us, it was a very conscious decision to keep Castles small and stripped back, because we'd much, much rather leave the player wanting something more than have them feel like, oh, this idea was cool 5 minutes ago, but I'm kind of done with it now.
Yeah, yeah. I think there seem to be, within the BAFTA nominations this year, there seem to be a lot of games which are treating story in a really interesting way. And, you know, I feel, I don't know about you, Barry, but I feel like the sense of how to tell a story in video games has really changed, both at the AAA side with things like The Last of Us, but also, you know, at the sort of the indie end of things as well, with things like Device 6, which tells a story through kind of text and through the interface of a phone in a very interesting way. And do you get that feeling as a developer that we're kind of evolving our sense of how to deal with story?
Absolutely. I have to say, like, one of my pet peeves over the years about video games is how seriously story was taken when the stories were blatantly crap. I mean, like, across the board, year after year, the best games in the world had terrible stories and terrible writing, terrible characters. I think that something like The Last of Us definitely delivered a bit of a sledgehammer to what was possible. And it wasn't the first. Even Bioshock did some really interesting stuff a couple of years ago, when they had their ambient storytelling method where you picked up the tape recorders and the story was told to you while you played. And that, to me, is like, now that's how you treat a gamer, right? Is you let him play the game and you don't tell him everything that he needs to know all the time. You just sort of, you build up the atmosphere and let them have something going on in their own heads, so their imagination sparked a bit, rather than it just being this passively, you know, the story was always just handed to the player through cutscenes or through, you know, mission statements and all of this. And I'm much more interested in, you know, the Minecraft type attitude, which is just inhabit the world and let the player create the story themselves as much as possible. And and I think the Last of Us just treated it seriously enough to do something that you could genuinely say was not rubbish. You know, and this is important. That's an important moment as far as I'm concerned, because it's people taking that side of video games seriously for the first time. I think it's really beginning to happen. And look at Device 6. You know, I think these things are interesting because they're working with the interactivity of video games, not because they've always felt bolted onto me, and that's why they're bad. They were never taken seriously enough.
Jack, I wonder if, one thing that Barry said there was this idea of games telling narrative or stories through space and through exploration. I think one really good example of that this year is a game that actually is up against you guys, which is in the best debut games, and that's Gone Home.
Right, Should we talk about Gone Home?
I think we'll probably have to, unfortunately, even if it's against you two.
No,
I think,
not at all.
I think, Gone Home is a game by a small development studio called Fulbright that was set up jointly by Steve Gaynor, who was on the BioShock development team. And this it's essentially a story. You are a character exploring a house. You've come home. You've been away for a year. You've come home to your parental home. No one's there. You don't know what's happened. And the whole story is told to you through answer phone messages, notes you find around the house. It's very environmental, isn't it? And do you think this is a kind of where stories are going?
I think it's really phenomenally exciting because as a writer, for a long while I was very frustrated, like Barry says, about how writing was seen as a little box that was ticked at the end of development. You know, they make some interesting sequences, and then you bring in a writer, and they'll write you a few cutscenes. And if you're lucky, they might write you an audio diary. And that doesn't encourage good writing. That doesn't even encourage good writing from good writers, because the writer looks to it and they go, "Oh God, what am I going to do here? What's going to happen here?" And I think it's really interesting and super super heartening to see lately writers being treated more and more as very specialized systems designers, which is a double-edged sword. You know, that doesn't mean that, like, the ideal state is one in which writers don't get ignored and writers don't swan into game studios and go, "I'm going to tell a story." Like, what you want is a member of your team that is as important as, for example, an animation lead or an art lead or a level design lead, except this person is just very specific at understanding the systems that are provided to them and understanding how best to extract interesting narrative from those systems. And I think Gone Home is just a phenomenal example of this, because Steve understands game design remarkably, as does Carla. And I think that their approach to the game views the story and the game as one thing. They're the same thing. There's no, "Oh, here's 50% story and here's 50% game." In Gone Home, you don't go, "Oh, I've been doing game for a while. I want some story."
Yeah.
You know, the story is everything. The story is even the most mundane interactions in Gone Home. It's picking up binders and looking on the other side of binders. It's opening cupboards and finding tissue boxes and things. And that's storytelling. That's storytelling as much as or storytelling more than suddenly throwing the player into a cutscene.
Yeah. Yes. I just wanted to maybe finish by going through the best games, the games in the best game list. I wanted you to say maybe which one of these you feel you'd like to see winning and why. So up for best games in 2014 are Assassin's Creed 4, Black Flag, Grand Theft Auto 5, The Last of Us, Papers, Please, which is a really fascinating game that we've not had a chance to talk about, unfortunately, but Super Mario 3D World and Tearaway. So it'd be really interesting to find, just as an end, say, if you could say which of those games you would like to see win and why. So, Jack, can we start with you?
Papers, Please. Absolutely. Papers, Please. It's... Man, we haven't talked about it.
I know, we should. I suddenly thought that when I mentioned it.
Yeah, Papers, Please is really, really fascinating.
I should explain. Papers, Please is another small independent produced game by a designer called Lucas Pope, and you are essentially a border guard in a fictitious Eastern European state.
Oztotska.
Yes. And you are dealing with a sort of endless queue of people who are applying to enter the state, and the rules keep changing. So on some days you're only allowed to let in certain people from certain territories. On other days it's a little bit freer, but the rules and regulations keep changing, and you've got to get through and let in as many people as you can in a day, because that's how you earn your money to feed your family.
And I think we should be clear that this game is very much an interesting artistic statement, but more than that, the fundamental gameplay underpinning it is brutal, just in terms of how it is to play. It's a game about... It sounds like I'm underselling it when I'm saying it. It's a game about cross-referencing things.
It's a game about tidy desks.
It's a game about tidy desks. And, you know, in the beginning, you're fine because you're like, oh, okay, fine. I know the logo of this passport. I can just check. I'm gesturing with my hands on the table here. I can just check this over here. And then suddenly in 3 days' time, you're like, okay, fine. Now, I know that some forgeries look like this, but some forgeries also look like this. And this is a completely fictitious stamp, and I've no idea where it's come from. And this man is offering me a lot of money, and all of my family is starving, and should I let him in? But earlier, somebody actually called me out for bribes, and so I don't even know what to do. And it manages to actualize moral horror in physical gameplay mechanics, and that's astonishing.
Yeah, you said, Matt Lees said in the in Charlie Brooker's documentary on games, he said about it that it you understand like the routine nature of evil.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In that
absolutely.
we can easily become evil just doing our jobs because there's certain things we feel we've got to do and we can't get out of doing. I'll take that bung from the person who wants to get into my country because my family are starving.
Yeah,
and you drift into behaviours which look like evil,
and it's astonishingly stressful to play. Just because it's unremittingly awful, and I mean that in a really great way. But it's just unremittingly bleak.
So bleak,
and but it's got a kind of an interesting sense of humour to it. Individual people's stories will begin to unfold through the narrative. The main menu is a masterclass in comedy music. It's a really interesting game.
And the old guy who comes in because he just wants to chat.
Yeah, the old guy.
And you're
guy,
desperate to yeah. process people as quickly as possible, yep. and he's telling you his life story.
It's like, hey man, yeah. hey. I would be so thrilled to see Lucas win.
Barry.
I would say I would be very happy to see Tearaway or GTA win for very different reasons, actually. Tearaway, I think the world that they realised was just so amazing. The sort of consistency of it all and the how it was also, you know, each part of it was very sympathetic to the other part.
And it's a PlayStation Vita game, isn't
yeah.
it? Where you're in a kind of a handicraft world and you have to deliver a letter, don't you?
Yeah, you're helping... the little character who's either Atua or Iota, you're helping this little character deliver a message, basically. In fact, you are the god that all the people in the game tend to worship. And so it uses the camera to put your face in the game, and you can actually reach in using the touchpad and affect the game world in a really interesting way. And because it's all about, the world is made of paper, folded paper, just everything just works in sympathy with that idea rather than working against it. And doing anything touch-based is dodgy and difficult, especially when it comes to gameplay and feel and stuff like this in software. And I just think they managed to crack that really well. I'm just biased in lots of ways with Tearaway, because not only do I know the people, very good friends of mine, it's also plays to my love of amazing worlds. And it does it just so well, so majestically on such a handheld device, which normally doesn't get that kind of really interesting stuff appear on it. So I'd be really happy to see that win. GTA 5 I'd be happy to see win, because I think really good stuff just has to be commended when it appears. And I think GTA, because they're so successful, they tend not to get as much love as other developers because they make balloon loads of money. but you can tell, I mean, just by playing the game, that the amount of effort and care and attention that went into it is just incredible. And it's the artistry of the guys. And I'm not saying that they succeed in everything they try and do, but they really are pushing it as much as they can every time. And, you know, just the first time, having played GTA 5, I remember the first time the nighttime arrived and going up into the hills and looking down on the city and just thinking, like, you know, this is just magic these guys are pulling out for us to experience. And again, I love games that have player agency. So I got a lot of joy out of it, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's very few game moments in AAA that are as potent as flying a helicopter over a city with Don Johnson's heartbeat playing in the background.
That's right.
Dan, what do you think?
I was going to say Papers, Please, but Jack sort of took that, so I'm going to say The Last of Us for balance.
Okay.
this is why we work together.
Yeah, exactly. It worked. Yeah, we can see it in motion.
The Last of Us is just amazing. I feel it's what AAA should have been doing for quite a while. I think it does what it does very, very well. I think both The Last of Us and its DLC, which I'm not sure counts, but the Left Behind DLC, is absolutely incredible. And my favorite game of all time now is Gone Home, and The Last of Us and its DLC sort of feels like a, in a lot of ways, like a AAA, well, it's a quote-unquote AAA reflection of that. Like, it's about human stories, it's about these things, and yes, it does it in a very occasionally bombastic way, and it does it in, it's still a third-person shooter, but its focus on storytelling and characters I really, really appreciated. The way it respected the player I thought was really, really good, and I would love to see more games doing what it's doing in that big budget sort of space.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Last of Us really was that it really challenged the way games, and I'm not going to give away the ending because it would be awful of me, but it challenged the way that we expect game narratives to finish. I mean, I found the ending kind of devastating, and again, like Papers, Please, in a way, it questioned like your motivations, both of the character motivations and your own motivations as a player, I think, in a really kind of special way, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think not only that, but The Last of Us, the ending especially, we're not too used. I mean, obviously it happens, but we're not too used to seeing that big... No, I'm not going to say the ending. But in that big budget space, we're not too used to having characters who make us feel that conflicted.
Okay, well, that's it. Thank you so much for coming. I'm just going to probably say that for me, it's probably Papers, Please, or Grand Theft Auto 5. Maybe with a tiny bit of Last of Us, and maybe a bit of Super Mario. Super Mario. And Tearaway is quite good as well.
Just all of them.
Yeah. So, thank you to Dan, to Barry, and to Jack for joining me, and good luck to you all for the BAFTAs. Yeah. I suspect, when this goes online, it'll only be decided, and you'll know. But... good luck for then. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
For the best games coverage on the web, go to theguardian.com/games. That's all we have for you this week. Do join us next Wednesday for more. From me, Alex Kratosky, and our Tech Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.